Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin, in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. The guests on this episode are Anna Peschek of Over the Moon Farms in Iowa and Kara Shannon of the ASPCA, talking about some recent efforts to overturn laws in states that were passed in order to better protect welfare of animals in concentrated animal feeding operations. So California passed Prop 12 quite a while ago now, and the industry has been doing everything they can to try to overturn that law. So they actually took the case to the Supreme Court, and a very pro-business Supreme Court decided that, yes, indeed, California had the right to set their own rules when it comes to these operations. And since that time, the industry has been trying to get a law passed through Congress that would overturn those laws. One of the first efforts to do that was called the EATS Act. Now that has been renamed the Save Our Bacon Act. And so the guests are going to be talking about what that means for small farmers who are trying to have independence and do things a little bit differently when they're competing against this massive industry that pushes towards the concentrated animal feeding operations model. And it has some really interesting implications for whether states have the ability to set their own rules and standards when it comes to things like animal welfare and environmental laws. And I'll also mention that after this podcast was recorded, a group of about 200 small farmers went to Washington, D.C. to lobby against passing the law that would overturn the state rules. And also Senator Harkin, as I'll mention a couple times in this podcast, wrote an op-ed where he also argued against overturning those rules. So with that, I will jump into my podcast and we'll go from there. I am really excited today to be joined by Anna Peschek from Over the Moon Farm and Kara Shannon from the American Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, also known as ASPCA, to talk about an issue that I think is really important. It was something formerly called the EATS Act, now known as the Save Our Bacon Act, and I think potentially something that might be inserted in the Farm Bill. And it's an issue that I know Senator Harkin cares about. He wrote an op-ed in June for the Des Moines Register about it. So we're going to be talking about this issue and its relevance to the connection between agriculture and public health and the environment and animal welfare, and also talking about this question of how it impacts local farmers. So thank you both for joining me. I'm really excited to talk to you. I thought, first of all, Kara, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what the Save Our Bacon Act is, a little bit about its history and how it came about and what the intentions are behind it and what the arguments are for and against.
Absolutely. And thank you for having us, Adam. So the Save Our Bacon Act is the latest iteration of a fight that's been going on for over a decade now, actually. And it's a fight that is a direct result and direct reaction to the success of state laws that try to improve the standards for farm animals. So California's Proposition 12 is one that you most hear about in this broader debate. That's a law that bans the sale of products coming from systems that are caging or crating animals in spaces so small that they can't even turn around. So that's gestation crates for mother pigs, battery cages for egg-laying hens, and then veal crates for veal calves. So like I said, this started over a decade ago. The first iteration we saw of the SOB Act, or the EATS Act, as we're continuing to call it, was in 2014, right out of Iowa, from Representative Steve King. And that's the first farm bill cycle where we saw it come up. And that was, again, language that would have prohibited states from passing laws like Prop 12 that set standards on the sale of agricultural products. They were unsuccessful in 2014, but Rep. King did introduce it as a standalone bill in 2015. And pretty much since then, we've seen attempts in every farm bill cycle to try and get language in there that preempts states' ability to pass laws that regulate animal agriculture. Obviously, that's an incredible federal overreach. This whole country is founded on the fact that states have the ability to pass laws both to protect animal welfare, to protect consumers. And these pie-in-the-sky crazy laws, these are very basic protections that, again, just say that animals can't be kept in crates so small that they can barely move. And they're also really popular. So Proposition 12 and Massachusetts Question 3 were both passed by ballot initiatives. So voted on by the people in those states and passed with pretty overwhelming margins. Prop 12 passed with about 63% of the vote. And Massachusetts Question 3 passed with almost 80%, which is pretty unheard of for folks who follow ballot initiatives. So incredibly popular, which makes it that much more concerning that the federal government is attempting to overturn them. And most of the push behind that, which has gotten us to where we are today with another fight for the EATS Act, which is now transitioned to be called the Save Our Bacon Act, because advocates and farmers were so successful in pushing back against previous attempts to oppose the EATS Act. We've now got a brand new name. Same bad idea, but brand new name. So we are in for the fight. We've got a farm bill that's supposed to be coming as we record the podcast today. Congress is currently shut down, so I couldn't give you a timeline. We're already over 2 years late, so really no one can give you a timeline. But we know that we are going to see a farm bill draft that has some type of language, whether it's the EATS Act, the Save Our Bacon Act, that is attempting to overturn these state laws. And the vast majority of that pressure is coming from the pork industry. It's actually really interesting because, again, I mentioned that the laws cover pork, eggs, and veal, and the pork industry is really the only one pushing back against them. Overwhelmingly, the egg industry has already transitioned to meet consumers' desire for more humane food. We've got about 50% of the industry already cage-free, so they are invested in keeping these state laws on the books because they've already invested in those transitions. But the pork industry is not nearly as close, and they want to really maintain their status quo. They don't want to invest in getting pigs out of crates, and some of the bigger companies who have already made that transition also have a desire to maintain their niche in the marketplace. Because if everyone's raising pigs crate-free, how are they going to get their premium, right? So there's a lot of complicated things at work, but ultimately we know that overturning these state laws, not simply existing laws, but in the future, no state could ever pass another law regulating animal products. It's hard to even fathom what that means for animals, because that's been such a useful lever towards progress and towards building a more humane food system. It would overturn decades of really valuable work. And again, it's just a federal overreach that we don't see in other industries. You know, we're not seeing these attempts to limit states' ability to make any positive change and have a say in the types of products that are selling in their markets. We know that consumers don't want to support cruelty. So like I said, we're in it for another fight, but we've beat back these attempts for over a decade. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue to do it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure even in Iowa, the polling I've seen, if you describe the conditions of some of the farms, people don't like the way that hogs are currently being raised. And so it makes sense that there would be such overwhelming margins in California and Massachusetts of voters trying to set their own standards. It's funny that the bill has gone through so many different iterations, the SOB Act or the Steve King Act. Both of those might have their own negative connotations for some people. But I did want to bring up, it seems like the pork industry really had been throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks. And one of the things that was surprising to me was they had been trying to challenge this in the court. And what is pretty pro-business Supreme Court actually sided against the pork industry. Is that correct?
Yeah, the pork industry has been pushing back against these laws pretty much from the day after they passed. So they litigated Prop 12 all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I think everyone was a little unsure of what that outcome was going to be. We were all pretty nervous that day and were surprised that they upheld it as constitutional. Anyone who's gone to law school, like constitutional law, you learn states have the ability to regulate commerce to protect consumers and animal welfare and other public values. So we had a win in the court, but I think that one downside of that was that it motivated the industry. If they lost there, they were going to win in Congress. So we've really seen the push ramping up, and they now have an administration that's a little friendlier to it. So even though we've been successful for over a decade in pushing back, we're probably the most vulnerable given the makeup of the folks that are drafting the farm bill this year. But the narrative that you'll hear from folks who support the EATS Act is that we need to overturn these state laws, because if we don't, farmers are going to go out of business. These are burdensome regulations that they can't meet, and it'll push them out, which is just false. First, anyone who's paid attention to what's putting farmers out of business is not new markets for premium products. It's the consolidation in the industry that's pushing farmers out every day. And we hear from farmers like Anna that these are really important markets. Whether you're selling into California, Massachusetts, there's over a dozen state laws in different states across the country that ban confinement in some form. These are really important market opportunities to sell into, but also just market signals to people that actually there are more humane options. You don't have to go with the status quo. So it's really important to keep them on the books.
Your comments about who the bill really benefits remind me of a quote from Senator Harkin in his op-ed that I will read. So he wrote, "By overturning Prop 12 and similar state laws, this provision would not only trample voter-approved initiatives, it would undercut family farmers who have invested in more humane practices. Instead, it rewards massive conglomerates like Smithfield Foods, which is owned by a Chinese corporation, that want to impose one-size-fits-all rules favoring industrialized systems over community-based agriculture." So we're lucky on the podcast today to have a family farmer, Anna Peschek. So Anna, could you tell us a little bit about your farm in Iowa and how you came to be where you are in your current farming practices?
Absolutely. Thank you, Adam. And thank you, Kara, for the policy overview. It's really helpful context for all of us to have. So I co-own Over the Moon Farm. We're based in Delaware County, Iowa. So that is on the eastern side of the state. We're located in a very rural area. Our closest town is population 600 and the other closest town is population 300. We are in some ways kind of a needle in the haystack of a farm business. We raise Sparrow to Finish, purebred Berkshire pork outside and in a crate-free, barren crate-free setting. We also raise pastured poultry, so I raise chickens, ducks, and turkeys. And then part of our business is also partnering with other primarily young and beginning farmers to provide opportunities for their products. So we partner with other farmers in central Iowa, young farmers who are producing grass-fed beef, partnering with a farmer who's doing pasture-raised lamb, and then another farmer who's also doing pastured poultry. So really, our farm is focused on trying to build a more resilient, humane supply chain here in Iowa and have a greater impact overall. So we've been in business since 2019. We're at year six, so still in the early years of running a business. We farm on a multi-generational family farm. And so we have been raising pigs using some infrastructure that used to be used for pigs, like many farms in Iowa who had diversified livestock up until the 80s and 90s when the market crashed. And so we've pretty much been raising pigs the entire time that Over the Moon has existed. We were raising just a handful of feeder pigs. So those are weaned pigs that we were buying from other farmers, just in small numbers, getting a handful at a time, until 2021, when we decided that we wanted to bring sows back to the farm because we wanted a consistent supply of the breed of pig we wanted, but we also wanted some increased control over the supply chain. One, because then we could be in control of the animal welfare standards. And also because we knew it would be something that we were good at. Both my wife and I, we co-run Over the Moon together and both have a lot of experience with livestock. And we couldn't find a consistent supplier of feeder pigs that could meet our needs. And we're always up for a challenge. And so sows were a challenge we decided to take on in 2021. We purchased 3,000. That was the last time we purchased any pigs from the farm. We've been running a closed herd, which means that everything is born on the farm. And those are the genetics we keep. I should say we do bring boars in to keep our genetics moving along. But that's the only thing that's being purchased in. And we went from those three initial sows to, we have like 18 right now, the combination of sows and then gilt, who are female pigs that have not given birth yet, but will give birth later this fall. And so then we are raising all the babies they have on the farm for meat. And we are selling all of those finished pigs into the direct-to-consumer market through our own brand, through Over the Moon. And then we're selectively keeping females to continue growing our herd. And our pig journey has been a wonderful experience. They're probably my favorite thing that we raise on the farm. It's a challenge. I'm really proud of the product that we raise. I'm really proud of how different it is from grocery store pork, both in the nature of how it's raised and also the actual quality of the product. And so we're running a decentralized pork business. We're taking our finished animals that are ready for butcher to small artisanal butchers, USDA inspected within 2 hours of the farm. We're doing value-added products like salami, And we're selling our product all across the state of Iowa, and also we ship nationwide. I think we've sold to more than 30 states at this point, but we're getting there in terms of our bigger footprint.
One really interesting thing you said is that you chose this path because you wanted to have more control. And I think one of the arguments the industry sometimes makes is that California or Massachusetts are trying to impose control over farmers. But from things I hear, the current pork industry actually is very controlling of farmers' decisions. And so could you say a little bit more about how this actually gives you more control by choosing to go outside of the current dominant business model?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to bring up. So the pork industry is vertically integrated. It is super consolidated. Meatpacking in general is controlled just by four major companies. We mentioned Smithfield and its control of the pork industry earlier. What that type of concentration means is that there is a super high level of corporate control over production practices. And that looks like everything from what pigs are fed. It looks like the breed of pig. It looks like the carcass weight. Because it is so hyper-efficient and standardized that there is no deviation from the norm, right? And it is all controlled by a handful of corporations. And so farmers, oftentimes, we use the language of farmer in place of corporation. And it's a complicated, nuanced thing, right? Because there is farmers and people, and I am very conscious of not erasing that. But then there is also decisions being made on a corporate level. So I think it's important to note how little control farmers often have over their own production practices. And I, as a farmer and someone in community with many people in my own area with a wide variety of production practices and experiences, my personal motto is being soft with people and hard on systems. And that's how I move through, especially the animal welfare world. So that being said, right, being hard on systems and soft on people, people often have been backed into corners, and the industry has backed all of pork production into corners. And so for someone like me, there really is no alternative, but there is no space in the mainstream market for a mid-size, small and small, but I am mid-size when we compare us to other direct-to-consumer farms. Well, mid-size are big, you know, we're certainly bigger than a hobby farm. And when I look at it, when I'm at the farm and I'm doing chores, I'm like, oh, we have quite a lot of pigs. And we're selling quite a bit into the direct-to-consumer market. We're moving a lot of pork. 100 pigs a year is a lot of pork. 300-pound pigs. Not nothing, but there is no room for us in the commodity commercial market. One, there's no way to sell our pigs into an open market because an open market doesn't exist. Again, we talked about the vertical integration. The price of hogs is also artificially low because of the way that the system has been set up. And so there's that aspect. And it's also the way that the entire industry is consolidated and integrated. You couldn't even be taking pigs like ours to a pack house, right? We're raising Berkshire heritage pigs that have black hair. I mentioned that because it takes more cleaning to get black hair off of a pig, which is part of why we raise white pigs with white hair. And so there's all different factors that make it impossible for someone of our size, of our diversity, to sell into any type of mainstream market. So my only option is to have my own brand and to sell direct to consumer in a decentralized system, taking my own pig to a processor, selling the meat myself under my own brand with my own standards and having control of that system. And I think that that is powerful. And as I mentioned before, we also raise birds and I love raising birds on pasture, but I often think about how much more control I have over our hog production because we own the genetics. And that's not the case in the poultry industry because of the way that industry has been consolidated and the way in which birds are like seeds and they're patented and owned. And so that's a whole different conversation. But owning the genetics of the pig, and we worked super hard and been very selective about having pigs that work in our system, that are great mothers, that are independent, that have good nesting instincts, that are really conscious of their babies and have big litters and good milk and all these things we've been able to slowly control for in a way that we wouldn't otherwise be able to.
One of the things that reminds me of is during COVID, when slaughterhouses, there was a period where they were closed for a little bit before Trump issued some executive order. Yep. But a lot of pigs had to be culled without going to a slaughterhouse. And you might think, well, why not have them live a little bit longer and then go to a slaughterhouse? But the reason I think touches on what you were talking about, where because Smithfield owns the pigs and owns the slaughterhouses, they have an exact specification of the pig has to be this many pounds in order for it to enter the slaughterhouse. And they also have genetics for pigs where they grow really fast. And so if you miss this short window of time when they're supposed to be sent to slaughter, they can no longer be killed at their packing house. So I found that really fascinating, just how much control is put on the people who are raising the pigs. You touched on this a little bit already, but a question maybe both for you, Anna and Kara, could you say a little bit more about what the life of a pig on your farm looks like in contrast to the life of a pig in a confined animal feeding operation? What does the experience look like for them?
Yeah, I can talk about a little bit about our pigs, but I also wanted to just respond quickly to one thing that you mentioned, Adam, that has always been important to me
and the challenges we face in the supply chain, which is that when we experience concentration, we might increase efficiency, but we also concentrate risk. And I think there is very few industries that that's as apparent in as the pork industry. So you mentioned COVID, obviously the packing house problems, but that's also true for disease. It's true for market access. It's across the board. So I just always think it's important to point out concentration equals concentrated risk. And yes, going back to the question about what a life looks like for one of our pigs, thinking about our sows. So, you know, a sow is a female pig that's given birth. So we keep our sows all together. So they're a group. I know them all. They all have slightly different makeups. Their faces are different. They have different personalities. They don't have names, but I know them all. I can point them out. I will say that we have one Bertha. She was our matriarch. We have many Bertha's daughters at this point. So for a while they were Bertha 1 through 7, but that got really confusing. But I know them all. They have personalities. I watch them interact with one another. I watch them interact with the changing seasons, which is one of my favorite things when the snow starts falling. I actually love pigs in the winter because I like the deep bedding, and it's honestly, it's easier to keep them warm than cool. I get less stressed about them in the cold than I do when it's 110 degrees out. But I watch them interact as the year goes on, and year after year, we're keeping them as long as we can. And when they are close to giving birth, so we monitor them every day, we're doing pig chores multiple times a day, and they know us and we have close, friendly relationships with our pigs. I monitor their milk production. And when that milk comes in, they'll be about 12 hours away from birth. And there's other signs too. Pigs nest. And so we give them bedded pens when they're about to give birth, pens that they have plenty of room to move around and to nest and to eat and to be comfortable. And so we give them hay and corn stalks, and they build a nest with their mouths and with their legs, and that's where they bear their young. And so one, that's a fundamentally different experience. The fact that they have the ability to use their natural instincts, which is to build a nest, to have their babies. And then again, we've really focused on our genetics. So the goal is obviously for that pig to like be successful on her own and to not have to have us intervene. We obviously pay attention. And if that sow needs assistance or veterinary intervention or whatever, we are paying close attention to that process. But for the most part, like, we want her to build her nest and to have her babies and to be successful at that. And then she has that like enclosed space with them for the first couple weeks, usually while they are nursing, and then they all get let out together. We usually have pig party central, little pigs. And again, that is just a wildly different experience. And then after she has babies, we do 2 litters a year. And so the pigs get weaned, they go back out as a group, and our pigs give birth in solo pens because that is also what works for our system and what works for the pigs. They don't have to compete with each other for feed. We can make sure the mother is getting all the feed and water that she needs, and we can make sure the babies are suckling, and we can make sure she has enough milk and supplement and whatever if we need to, but they're never confined to a crate. And they're with each other. I mean, pigs are social. They have relationships. They also have a hierarchy, especially sows. They have relationships with each other, who's boss and who's not, and all the things. And so they live a very different life. They're around for longer, certainly. And yeah, I love watching them raise their babies. They communicate. It's all these things. And then our feeder pigs, same thing. I think there's something really special about having an animal that lives its entire life with us. They're born on the farm. We take them to a butcher. I see a lot of trucks with pigs. The process of even taking our pigs to the butcher is so different. We're taking about 8 pigs at a time, which our trailer is too small for where we're at right now, but still, we're taking about 8 pigs at the time. I wish we could take 15, but we bed the trailer. We don't even force them on. We usually just like park it in the open lot and they walk on. We leave it overnight and they walk on and go to bed. we close the door, we drive. There's never the type of stress involved. I think that increases their meat quality, but it also feels good for the pig. We're very conscious of who we work with as butchers. We have watched the whole process. We feel it's very important for us to understand with our birds also. We've watched the whole process and make sure we understand and feel confident of who we're working with. But it's such a different experience. And then even when it comes time for a sow to go, if she has a health concern, she can't have babies anymore, or is a danger to her piglets or us, which does happen with genetics, we're very conscious of that. And the animal goes into our meat supply. And there's something really special about that and about feeding our community. So it's an entirely different process. It's really incomparable. We're looking at our 100 pigs compared to confinement of 2,999 or 4,000.
Yeah. Reminds me, there's a farmer, Kevin Fulton, maybe you guys both know him, but he had a statement. He raises animals, I think, similar to your methods, Anna, and he had a statement that my pigs have one bad day in their life. That most of their lives are really happy and good, but they have one day that's a little rough, but otherwise, you know, they have good lives overall, which is in contrast to the way that most pigs are raised in this country. I was really glad you mentioned natural behaviors, Anna, because I do know that pigs are very social and they like nesting and they have rooting behavior where they dig around in the dirt. Kara, I was wondering if you could, in contrast to what Anna was describing, could you say a little bit more about the standard practice of a lot of confined animal feeding operations and what operations would be ruled out by Proposition 12 in California in contrast to the better settings that Anna was describing?
Yeah, I get to paint the bleak picture after Anna got to talk about her happy pigs. But yeah, the difference is stark. The industrial system, for one, it's quite integrated and sectioned off. So there's far fewer farms that are raising their pigs from farrow to finish. So birth to end of life and slaughter, it's much more segmented. So you have farms who are just doing the farrowing and the babies are born there. And then sometimes they don't even stay there through weaning. There are nursery farms where they wean and then they go from the nurseries to the finishing operations. So even that alone, you're talking about more transport, which is one of the most stressful things for an animal. And this is instances where they don't have bedding in any weather, hot or cold. But the basic difference is that they are entirely confined indoors the entire time. They are on concrete slatted flooring, which becomes an issue for pigs, which have hoof feet. They often will fall into the slats and get stuck. In the farrowing operations, this is where gestation crates come in. It's just one piece of the system. It's one part. And gestation is the period when a sow is pregnant. And in the industrial system, they are kept in a gestation crate, which is just barely bigger than the sides of their bodies. They can stand up. They can lie down in it. That's about it. Again, we said these are incredibly intelligent social animals. They are incredibly stressed in those systems. And we often see that manifested and them chewing on the bars of their crates so much that their mouths will bleed. Like, they are incredibly stressed in those systems. So they're in the gestation crates. And then when they are going to give birth, they transition to a farrowing crate, which is a slightly bigger crate, which allows them to give birth and the piglets stay with them through weaning. Again, slatted flooring, no bedding, none of the things that a pig would naturally do, like I said, with the rooting, and they want to build those nests. And industry says that they have to do that, otherwise the mother pigs will roll over on and kill their pigs. But again, as we've just heard from Anna, when they have the space and everything they need, we see very low incidence of that. All of the farmers that we work with that are raising pigs out on pasture, that's not happening under rain. It's very rare that you're losing piglets that way. So it's really, it's quite horrible. There's really no other way to put it. Not much of an existence for these pigs. No part of it is allowing them to carry out their natural behaviors. And often it's interesting, even when industry does share pictures of their finishing operations, that's where pigs are group housed at the very end. And they often will share photos of them when they've just arrived and they're pretty small. And it looks like they have enough space they can kind of run around a bit. But once they're at slaughter weight, they are packed into group housing. Yeah, it's bleak. And again, that is the vast majority of how pork is produced in this country. Farms like Anna's are the minority. And again, we know from our base, ASPCA, we know we have 2 million supporters across the country who we know 80% of people don't like confinement. They don't want to be supporting animals that are raised like this. And if things like EATS passes, we're just further consolidating and those products like Anna's become less accessible.
Yeah, it's just such a stark contrast, I think, in most people's minds. I can't speak for everybody. But I guess a lot of people think that slaughter itself is something that's unpleasant. But if an animal lives a happy life and then was killed painlessly for human food, that seems like a trade-off that a lot of people are comfortable with. But it's a totally different equation if it's an animal that their whole lives are in these conditions where they don't have access to the outside or sunlight or nesting material. It just seems like a different kind of ethical trade-off between those two different cases. I wanted to ask you both about, even with the Proposition 12 passing and the Massachusetts proposition being passed, or higher welfare standards being passed, it still seems like the policies are stacked quite a bit in favor of the current model. And so I wanted to ask you both, maybe especially you, Anna, are there policy changes that you could see even beyond Proposition 12 that would give a more fair opportunity for farmers like yourself? And what would they look like?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I think it's multifaceted. So I think one, fundamentally, as you just mentioned, the policies are stacked against firms like ours. By and large, the policies we have really support the multinational corporations involved in our incredibly vertically integrated, incredibly concentrated industries. So the policies are already stacked against us. So for myself as a young farmer, looking to a farm bill that I hope passes one day, we need more funding and more support for beginning farmers. We need more support for higher welfare farmers, and we need market access. So speaking from my own experience, my farm suffered and is still suffering a very challenging year due to the funding cut that was made in March of 2025 for the Local Food Purchasing Assistance Program, the Local Food for Schools program. So I was selling, depending on the season, 10 to 20% of my product through that program into local food banks, schools, childcare centers, etc. I love raising pigs to go feed my community and think that all people of all socioeconomic classes should have access to high quality proteins, and especially when we're looking at systems where the trade-off is so high. And I want to raise food for my community, and market access programs like that are very, very, very important. And so the funding was cut. We're hoping for reinstatement in the farm bill. Again, if it passes, I've been fighting really hard for that legislation. But that is just one example of a market opportunity that can help farms like ours remain viable. And when you have viable marketplaces, it's easier to do things like make a decision to start farrowing pigs and go from raising a few pigs to raising a few hundred, which actually has like impact. And it was in part because of that program and the increased market access that we had that we were able to scale in the way that we did. Now we're suffering the repercussions of that, which is that we scaled and then we lost market access. And so we're pivoting, which is very stressful and very exhausting. But we wouldn't have been able to do it if we weren't able to move. There was times where we could, let's say we could, you know, take 8 pigs to the butcher, and then we would be able to move 4 through a wholesale outlet. And that money helped pay for the butcher cost of all those 8 versus like the slow trudge towards profitability when you bring all that meat back and you sell it individually. It's just a much slower return on investment. And so we need market access opportunities. I'm also concerned, and we need to see conservation programs. We need the EQIP continue to be funded at a high degree. We need to make it easier for farmers like myself to access. We need young farmers like myself to have more land access opportunities so that people can scale. There is lower barrier to entry livestock production like pastured poultry, and then there's pigs. They take a lot more land, they take a lot more infrastructure, and they take a lot more cash flow. And so you need supports to make viable markets possible for especially mid-scale producers. So for me, it's making sure that we have farmers like myself and people doing similar things at the table with our policymakers. We're the experts in our system, but a lot of it comes down to market access and support. And I could go on and on because there's so many barriers. There's so many barriers to entry. We also need more large animal livestock vets that are independent to even service people like me. The list really goes on. And it really, for me, is about, I really, really believe that livestock are a key part of having resilient and vibrant rural economies, but we need the support to do so.
Yeah, I was going to mention that too, because there's such a big problem in Iowa and surrounding states about rural areas getting hollowed out and less and less population. You know, if you think about the scale of your business compared to a place that has 1,000 pigs, which isn't even one of the bigger ones, would you rather have 10 awesome small farms like yours, or would you rather have one operation that was doing all of that? And of course, the less the population can be sustained, the less people are going to live out in some of these other areas of Iowa.
And all the money leaves, right? I think that's important to understand, too. When I talk to policymakers and when I talk to other people in power about a business like ours, it's always really important for me to emphasize how much money is turned over from an operation like mine, especially as we've grown an operation like Hogs that just does take more cash flow. We're buying a lot of feed from a local feed mill. We're spending a lot of money at the butcher. We're turning a lot of money over for an operation of our size. And it is a sharp contrast to see money that is flowing out of both our rural communities and also flowing out of the state.
Thank you. I guess a couple of different questions. One thing I was wondering is we've been talking a lot about animal welfare, but it seems like the Save Our Bacon Act has implications for other things like the environment and public health. So I was wondering if either one of you would want to comment on how it might connect to those things as well.
I can give it a go. And I might add on to the conversation around policies. And like Anna said, there's a million things that we could be doing. But I think it's really important that people understand how much we are subsidizing and propping up the industrial system, the amount of money, even great programs like BFIP that Anna said, which is a conservation program, which should be supporting exactly the types of systems we want to see, are funding manure lagoons. Like they are funding CAFO infrastructure with conservation funding. So even in the spaces where we're trying to do better, we're still somehow managing to funnel millions of dollars to industrial ag. And so much of that system is built in a way that allows them to just all of the expenses and the risk it's put on other folks. You know, Adam, we talked about COVID earlier and where they did have to depopulate pigs on farm because they couldn't get them to slaughter. And the American public paid for that. Our tax dollars did bailouts to those companies for a scenario that they could have anticipated would happen and could have contingency plans for and could have done all kinds of things. But instead, we continue to spend billions of tax dollars every year to bail them out. So federal policies like the Industrial Agriculture Accountability Act would go a long way in fixing that. Even a 2% swap of what we spend to prop up directly or indirectly industrial ag to higher welfare systems would be totally game-changing. So there's that. I had to get that out of the way. But in terms of impacts beyond animal welfare, obviously, when you're talking about industrial agriculture and factory farming, everything is intersecting. So the more that we are pushing towards consolidation, pushing towards this race to the bottom, which would happen if we pass the EATS Act and we overturn the bare bones standards that we've set in certain states, then everyone is motivated and incentivized to do the absolute least, to provide animals with the least space, to get bigger, which means more waste, more water pollution, more air pollution, less healthy rural community. Everything is impacted. We have farmers trapped in the system that are only going to be further unable to get out as the power consolidates above them with these companies. There's so many intersecting negatives, and the only people really gaining are the companies who have billions of dollars of profits, which makes all of this almost insulting when we're talking about EATS and they're talking about, well, we're going to put farmers out of business because they can't afford these changes. And it's like, you control everything from the feed to the pigs to where they're going, and you could absolutely afford to help them make these changes, and you're choosing not to, and you'd be choosing to allow them to lose their farms and go out of business. These are choices being made by them.
And you mentioned depopulating, and I think I used the word culling earlier. And since I stuck you with describing the depressing stuff earlier, Kara, I'll do it this time where I just feel like I have to mention that depopulation might not sound like that bad of a word, but the way in which it actually is done is absolutely horrific. There's something called ventilation shutdown, where they had hogs in a barn and they fill it up with heat or carbon dioxide, just really awful, awful methods that were tragic to hear about. I also liked your point about the subsidies, because I think one of the arguments that's sometimes made is that if we switch to these higher welfare systems, that the price of food is going to go up this huge amount. And that's ignoring the fact that we're already taking so much money to subsidize the system that we're running right now. So the arguments that these animal welfare systems are so much more expensive are often just ignoring all of the externalities that are coming out of the current system. And so I was wondering if either one of you wanted to comment on that general idea that if you're using higher welfare, if you have better standards, it's going to make stuff unaffordable.
Yeah, for me, it's all about the externalities. And we're talking about the externalities of these really horrible conditions, but also I think in Iowa, the externalities of what it has looked like in meatpacking plants and pork packing plants, especially in COVID, during the COVID days when those plants were ordered to stay open. Prior to that, I mean, we have the horrendous depopulation, but then we also have people literally dying working in these plants. And beyond COVID, incredibly unsafe, undignified conditions. It's horrific. And I always believe in speaking from what I know, and I don't work in a pork packing plant, so I can't speak to that experience. And there are many people that can. But when we talk about higher food prices, the price we're paying right now is so high, and that price is people's lives. It's animals, horrendous conditions with our water quality. We are paying for it in so many ways. And with what Kara was mentioning about the subsidies and my own experience with the local food purchasing assistance program, we have the brains. We can figure it out. We can figure out how to feed people in a way that is humane, dignified, that really believe that there are solutions. And again, these farms like mine, we recirculate so much money into the economy. And so I think we have an immense opportunity for more vibrant systems that produce so much more.
So for the listeners who would like to take action on this issue, what would you recommend them doing?
We can make change with both our vote and our fork. Whatever is the most accessible thing for them to do in that moment, do that. For example, we just talked about price. Some of the price points are inaccessible for people where they're currently at, especially as the price of healthcare and housing and everything else goes up. People are balancing a lot. So if all you can do is reach out to your person in Congress, that's huge already. They need to hear from folks. They need to hear that people value animal welfare and the environment and rural communities and farmers and people having real livelihoods and farming being something that's viable into the future. So you can email or call if you're not into calling. Email works just as well. And ASPCA actually has an alert that makes it super easy to do, where you just fill out your information and then we send emails out to all of your reps. So ASPCA.org/EATSACT will get you there. And whenever you have the opportunity to support farmers like Anna, whether like at your grocery store, at the farmer's market, at the co-op, it doesn't have to be all or nothing, which I think is also really important. I think folks feel like they hear all this and they feel like if they don't change everything overnight and they aren't perfect overnight, that there's no point in changing. But even if it's just your eggs, if eggs are where it's accessible and your price point meets and you can go for that pasture-raised egg, amazing, because you've at least opted out of factory farming in that space. So that's always the message I want people to hear. You don't have to be perfect. Any action that you can take in the moment is still so valuable and helpful to the cause.
And obviously, people should support Over the Moon Farms. Is there any easy way to check to see if a product is living up to the standards that you would recommend? Or is it something where you feel like people always need to know their local farmer and buy from someone that they know personally and can look in on the operation? What suggestions do you both have for that?
Well, I would say one thing is I appreciate Kara talking about how it's not all or nothing. This high standard we're talking about of having this personal relationship to your farmer and knowing them and asking questions and all these things is great, but it's not always accessible. And on this call, we're talking a lot about these systemic issues that we need change. So when you can have a personal relationship, that's great. When you can't have that personal relationship, I know the ASPCA has a guide to products, and I also know the Food Animal Concerns Trust has some specific guides. I also raise turkeys, and I know they put out a pasture-raised turkey guide every year for people looking for an alternative for their holiday meal. And so I think looking to trusted organizations that are doing some of the back-end vetting work when it's accessible to you and understanding that systemically it's often not. And the reason we're trying to raise standards across the board is because it should not be an individual's work to try to figure that out, because it is complicated and hard. And so that's one thing. And for me, it's supporting farms like ours. But I think more importantly, it's trying to get involved in policy where you feel like you can, because quite frankly, farms like ours need policy changes to survive. We also need people to buy from us. But I think more importantly, we need policy change so that we can make it into the next years of our business.
And so for people who are interested in policy change, Kara, does ASPCA have a dedicated email list to this issue?
Yeah, absolutely, we do. And first, I'll plug the consumer resources that Anna just talked about. If you go to ASPCA.org/grocery list, that's where we have a list of nationally available brands that have what we consider to be a meaningful animal welfare certification. So these are things that you'll be able to find in bigger grocery stores. And then we also have a list of farms by state who have one of those certifications, which is ASPCA.org/farms. If you go to any of those, there will be places to sign up. We have a factory farm task force for folks in particular who are interested in engaging on the farm issue. Obviously, the ASPCA has animal lovers of all kinds on our list, but we do have a special place just for folks interested in the farming world.
Great. Thank you both so much. I appreciate the work that you're doing. We spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the negative impacts of current industrial ag system. And so it's really wonderful to see alternatives to that, like what you're doing, Anna, and to learn that if our policy was structured a little differently, that businesses like Anna's could flourish and help grow into the market that's currently being dominated by a very different system. So really appreciate you both joining me, and I wish you success in your efforts.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at parkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.